We're here for the regular meeting of the Annuity and Pension Board, Employees Retirement System of the City of Milwaukee. Could I have a roll call, please?
Yes, Ms. Ford?
Here.
Mr. Helling?
Here.
Ms. King?
Here.
Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Mr. Conrad?
Here.
Mr. Kovak, not present as yet. Ms. Sala?
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Bell?
Here.
Quorum.
Good morning, everyone. We'll start right off with item number one, the approval of minutes regarding item A, regular meeting held March 28, 2023. Any comments or questions regarding? Not hearing any, I have a motion to approve the minutes for the regular meeting held March 28th, 2023.
This is Aicha. I'll make the motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you, Aicha. Do I have a second?
Ms. King will second.
Thank you, Ms. King. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any, the motion to approve the minutes for the regular meeting on March 28, 2023 passes. Moving on to item two, the Chief Investment Officer's report. Eric or David?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. This is Eric. I'll be handling this report today. I'll start with a performance update as usual, and then just have really one announcement to make after that. So the fund ended the month of March with a value of $5.64 billion, return of up 1.0%, net of fees underperformed by approximately 1%. The primary relative performance drivers were first the fund's public equity style bias, which detracted 64 basis points. And this was primarily value and small cap exposure. Within manager selection, private equity detracted 97 basis points. Again, this is something that we talked about at the investment committee meeting recently. This is really an artifact of the way private equity reports come in. Essentially, we're comparing private equity. We haven't received any reports for private equity yet, and we're comparing it to a benchmark that was up over 7% in the month. Real estate added 42 basis points within manager selection. And then finally, the fund's overweight to private equity added 15 basis points. And once again, this is just kind of an artifact of the way the attribution works. We're telling it that we're overweight to an asset class that had a benchmark return of 7%. So as far as the attribution's concerned, that benefits the fund. You can see in the table to the right that the fund has outperformed in the longer term time periods, 1, 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. Through April 24th, the fund is up approximately 0.4% in April, which brings the year-to-date return to up approximately 3.8%, and the fund value to $5.67 billion. 11 out of the fund's 16 active mandates are outperforming year-to-date, and the fixed income asset class is outperforming its benchmark year-to-date. Year-to-date, we've seen an investment change of $211.9 million, have paid out benefits and expenses of $123.3 million, and have received contributions of $111.9 million. For cash flows this month, there's a little bit more going on than a typical month. So what we're doing, we're redeeming $57.5 million from the fund's public equity managers. And then we're also expecting to receive $75 million from UBS as part of the redemption plan that was approved by the board in 2022. In addition to, of course, paying the monthly benefits, we'll all also be using the excess to deposit $50 million into the U.S. government bond index, and then likely another $45 to $50 million into REAMS, another one of our fixed income managers, although that amount hasn't been finalized yet. And what we're really doing here is, you know, if you'll see in the pie chart as well as the bar graph there that, you know, we ended March, you know, almost 1% overweight to public equity. So we're really just taking the opportunity to get some money out of public equity and avoid that, you know, that really kind of worst case scenario where we just draw fixed income down and down and down, you know, with benefit payments. So just taking this opportunity that the market gave us to replenish the fixed income allocation a little bit and, you know, get that a little bit towards its target and save up some liquidity, you know, for, you know, when we have potential market volatility in the future and, you know, may need to draw on fixed income again. So if there's any questions on this report, I'd be happy to take them at this time. Otherwise, as I said, there's really just one announcement for the CIO report.
Thank you, Eric. Any comments or questions regarding from board members or staff?
Mr. Chair, this is Molly.
Yeah, go ahead, Molly.
Eric, thank you for this report. It's been really good. Hey, I've been watching in the news recently, all this has, right? And I've noticed there's a few brick and mortar predominant stores that are now filing bankruptcy. And I'm curious, do you see this as something like your David see this as something that we should be looking at closely? For example, Bath and Beyond and now David's Bridal. These are more a lot of brick and mortar stores that are that I heard are filing bankruptcy. Is this something that we should be, it's on our radar, or is it something that we have to us, or how do you think, what do you see this going, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly Bed Bath & Beyond is the big one that's been in the news, and I think really, you know, it gets more, it's probably getting more news play than it otherwise would because it's, you know, one of those stocks that's been kind of classified as a meme stock over the past, you know, year plus. You know, it's a company that's been in long-term decline. It's, you know, they've been selling a lot of stock into the market recently, kind of taking advantage of their status as a meme stock to maybe stave off bankruptcy for, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months longer than they otherwise would have. So I don't know that, you know, what's specific to Bed Bath & Beyond isn't indicative of anything, you know, in the broader economy. You know, that this brick and mortar retail has been kind of a really long-term, you know, kind of downward trend, and this is really just the culmination of it. And, I'll share another anecdote, which is kind of the opposite side of this coin. Prologis, which is our logistics manager, you know, I went to their conference last year, and one of the things that they noted was that Bed Bath & Beyond was one of their larger exposures as a warehouse tenant, and it was something, you know, even as one of their larger exposures, it was less than 1% of their kind of, you know, square footage. And they were talking about the possibility of Bed Bath & Beyond going bankrupt then. And kind of paradoxically, they were excited about it because that would free up the space that Bed Bath & Beyond had at a long-term lease that's now below market rents. And that would allow them to lease that space that's very much in demand, you know, to a new tenant that and bring those rents up to market. So, you know, I guess there's always, you know, another side of the coin to these things as well. You know, so I think, yeah, again, to sum up, you know, nothing in particular about these bankruptcies that gives us any more or less fear about the broader economy than we had before. and really nothing specific to the portfolio that you know, that there's any impact from these. I think if anything, the fact that Bed Bath & Beyond was a meme stock, you know, would have gotten our investment managers away from it, you know, a year ago. So hopefully that answers your question.
No, that was really helpful, Eric. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Molly. Any other comments or questions regarding Eric's presentation?
Great. Mr. Just and one more comment. Just a reminder about the investment committee coming up on May 4th. Right now, you know, it looks like the plan is to, you know, continue the asset liability with study with Callan, look at some mixes, you know, and then we'll have some routine due diligence reports to present. And, you know, possibly a relatively routine guideline update request from UBS. That still is kind of dependent on them getting the request to us in time. But that's kind of what we're working on right now. So, yeah, unless there's any other questions, that concludes my CIO report.
Thank you, Eric. Any other comments? Thank you. Moving on to item three is the investment committee report. And I will start with Mr. Klusman, and then I can handle item A. And I won't need to go into closed session for that. So go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last week at our April 20th meeting, the investment committee unanimously elected Timothy Helling as its vice chair. Next, the investment committee interviewed two investment managers as part of the real estate manager search. Those investment managers interviewed were Harrison Street and Kane Anderson. The committee selected one finalist in closed session and directed ERS staff to conduct due diligence and coordinate the legal negotiations with the selected finalist. The selection is contingent on successful due diligence and contract negotiations. Staff also presented a preliminary first quarter performance update, noting that the fund's first quarter return would not be finalized for about another week. The fund's estimated first quarter return is 3.3% net of fees. The fund's estimated 10-year return is an annualized 7.9% net of fees. Finally, as Eric just mentioned, Callan will be presenting the next phase of the ALM study at our upcoming May 4th meeting. Staff emphasized the importance of this meeting by highlighting how inflation and higher interest rates will allow the committee to consider approving an asset mix with a fixed income allocation as high as 29%. The fund last had a target allocation to fixed income above 28% back in 2006. Staff also mentioned that setting the strategic asset allocation and the resulting return volatility and liquidity characteristics associated with it is the most important investment decision the committee makes. That's the conclusion of my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Any comments or questions regarding? Not hearing any. Just want to make sure, Jerry, I believe Tom covered letter A, the selection of the real estate manager.
Yes.
And since we already motion to approve during our investment committee meeting. Is that sufficient?
Yes.
Thank you. Great. If there's no other comments or questions regarding the investment report.
Yeah, Matt, the contract will come back to the full board. So there'll be another opportunity to look at the details of the terms and conditions of the agreement.
Thank you, Jared. Moving on to item number four, the Administration and Operations Committee report. And go ahead, Ms. Sella.
Good morning, everyone. The Administration and Operations Committee met last Tuesday, April 18th. We had one agenda item, which was the approval of the draft 2024 budget. And it is, we did recommend approval for it. Did we want to go through the budget quickly before the board approves it? Or did we just want to do a motion to approve? Ms. Jerry, did you want to maybe go through it quickly?
Well, Dan's here. Maybe I'll just ask him to just give a run down the summary page on the first page then.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This is Dan Gopal. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for ERS.
Dan, did you want to go through it then?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. So our 2024 requested total budget was for just over $24 million. That was an increase of about $271,000 from 2023. Most of that, the two main drivers of the increase are salary and fringe benefits. We've been working with DER, as you know, to do some market studies and reclasses. So that's why the salaries bumped up, and as a result, the fringe benefits bumped up as well. And then professional services, it's about $241,000 higher. Most of that is just an increase in the number of investment manager fees that we pay through the budget process. And we also reduced by $1.3 million our spending for IT equipment, just based on where we are on our hardware replacement cycle. And that's pretty much the main items. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Dan.
And we just need a motion to approve.
Yep.
Board moves approval.
Ms. Kimmel, second.
Thank you. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any objections, the approval of ERS 2024 budget passes. Ms. Howell, do you have anything else?
Nope, that concludes my report. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Howell. Moving on to item five, new business. We are going to shortly pass item A and move on to item B, retirements, death claims, and refunds for March 2023. Jerry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the packet is the normal monthly report, as Matt said, on retirement, death claims, and refunds for the month of March. And this is approval of the payroll, essentially. So unless there are some questions, I guess we could just call for a motion to approve the payroll and so we can pay the benefits. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Jerry. Any comments or questions regarding?
No, this is Molly. I'll make the motion to approve the payroll.
Thank you, Molly. Do I have a second?
I'll have a second.
Thank you, Tim. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any objections, the motion to approve payroll for March 2023 passes. Moving on to item five, letter C, conference requests, April 2023 board meeting. Go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, we have two here, two requests, actually three, including three people, that is. First one is for Tom Courtright to go to the 2023 Madison Investment Conference in Madison. It's a CFA society, and the fee for that is approximately $300, including travel expense. For Tom Courtright. And the second one is for Eric Sauer and David Walters to go to the Abbott due diligence, Neuberger Berman due diligence, and annual LP meeting for Neuberger. And that's, of course, in New York for both of those managers. The estimated cost is approximately $1,750 per person for travel and accommodations.
Thank you, Terry. And if I could just add a potential conference request for myself, was looking to attend the NCPRS Public Pension Funding Forum. It's just in Chicago. It's August 20th through the 22nd. Cost would be minimal. I haven't yet figured out the hotel cost, but that would basically be it, as I'd probably just take the train down or drive my own vehicle.
Well, Matt, I was going to also ask about that one as well as we got later in the year, but since you put it up, I'll ask to attend too. I'm just going to take the train, and so I'm going to ask for $75 for myself. It's a two-night conference, but I will stay with my son that lives in Chicago.
Since we're on the topic, I'd like to attend that conference also, but I thought it was kind of early to make the request.
Okay, so we've got Deborah, Matt, and myself requesting, and then we just have to have a motion to approve all of these.
Okay, so we have Mr. Portwright, and we have Mr. Sauer and Mr. Walters, and then Mr. Allen, Ms. Ford, and myself. A motion to approve those conference requests.
Conrad moves to approve.
Klusman will second.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Thank you, Mr. Klusman. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any, the motion to approve the conference requests for April 2023 board meeting passes. Moving on to item number six, medical reports. Letter A, all duty and disability applications and reexaminations for April. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you. So the first report in the packet is the medical panel approvals report. And all of these are reexaminations that are all recommended for approval by the medical panel. There's four of them. The second report is the medical council approvals report. The medical council is, of course, the council that is appointed by the board, just for everybody's information again. And we have one application on this one for ordinary disabilities from an MPS employee, school engineer, Brandon Purdy. This is a new application, and it's recommended for approval. The others are re-exams, and they are also recommended for approval as well.
Thank you, Jerry. Any comments or questions from board members regarding medical reports?
Mr. Bell, just so you're aware, Mr. Kovac has joined.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Kovac. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for your patience. I had another meeting that just wrapped up.
You bet. We passed on the survivorship, so we'll head back that way shortly. So I just need a motion to approve the medical reports for April 2023.
Kovac moves up.
Thank you, Mr. Kovac. Do I have a second?
Only a second.
Thank you, Tim. Any objections regarding? Not hearing any, motion passes. We'll move on to item seven, unfinished business, letter A, pending legal opinions and service request report. Be handled by Mr. McLean.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. Pretty short report. I don't have any specific comments, but I'd be happy to answer any questions any of the members might have.
Thank you, Patrick. Any questions, comments from board members? Not hearing any, we will move on to item B, the pending legislation report as well. Mr. McLean.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. The only comment I have on this one is that the part three item on there regarding the pension contribution offset, given the results of the litigation that we'll address later in the meeting, we can finally resolve that issue and should have a resolution by the next meeting.
Thank you, Patrick. Any comments or questions regarding? Not hearing any, we will move on to item C. Jerry, do you see a reason to go into a closed session, or are we okay with the executive director's report?
I don't think there's really a need to go into closed session at this point. It doesn't really involve litigation. There is one item at the end that I have an update on for the state legislation. If there's anything proprietary, it's all public record by now, but you can always go in at that point if people want to talk about anything that would involve the need to go in a closed session. So I'll just start at the top, a personnel update. We're working with DER as usual every month to fill positions, and lead pension specialist and pension accounting specialist. And a lead pension specialist was Barb Teichner, and Barb retired a month or so ago. And Mike Juke has been conducting interviews as recently as yesterday. And the pension accounting specialist moved on to another position last week. And so we've got a list of candidates to interview for that job as well beginning next week. So we're moving forward. These are both fairly important jobs. Well, all the jobs are important. These are mission critical jobs. The lead pension specialist is essentially the lead retirement counselor, and the pension accounting specialist is an integral part of preparing the payroll every month. And so we're not letting any dust gather in filling these positions. Our member services, we have approximately 30 retirees on the payroll last month, and we're looking for about the same number, 29, this month. And we did have some retiree deaths, unfortunately, in the month of January, 29. And the rest of it is pretty routine. Moving down to financial services, the 2024 budget was approved today, of course, and we're continuing to work both with the actuary and on the auditor on preparing our financial statements. We're also working to implement the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that Patrick's going to tell you about a little bit later in the meeting. And then we sent out the second round of outside earnings letters. This is in connection with disability for people who have, you know, outside employment. They have to report their 1040s to us every year. And so that we normally send a couple of letters. And so we're expecting to send those out right here in the next week before the month ends. Information services, all is going well. Jeffrey has been keeping us in good shape. Have no complaints about anything that's happening there. All the projects are on green light status. And then lastly, on administration, I put in my report at the time, I had written a report that, you know, we continue to provide information in connection with the discussions in Madison for pension funding and reform for both the city and the county. And at the time I wrote this, there was no pending legislation. There still has not been any legislation introduced into the assembly, but as of yesterday late, there is a draft bill that has been published. I don't know if it's been published, but it's circulating within the working group of the city and the county.
Jerry, the specific instructions in the draft were not for it not to be distributed.
Right.
Instructions from the state.
Yeah. Right. So I just want to let everybody know that effort is beginning to potentially come to fruition. So I apparently can't say too much about it at this point, but just wanted to let everybody know that it's beginning to happen. And so really that's all I have to say in this report. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Any comments or questions? I have one, but anyone else first? Not hearing any, either for Jerry or Nick, so with this time frame, with this pending legislation, what type of time frame are we looking at for potentially it being introduced publicly, or how does that all work?
Well, as you know, legislation has sometimes been described as sausage making, right? So we have, you know, two houses. We have the lower house, the assembly, and the Senate. And And of course, the governor has to sign off on it. All this is highly unpredictable. It's not clear whether or not it'll get through the assembly, and if so, whether the Senate has a different version of the bill. I mean, there is no projected timeline. It's just a negotiation that goes on as long as it does, if it actually gets adopted. So I'll keep everybody posted more as the bill gets introduced, but at this point it hasn't even been introduced formally.
The only thing I would add is, I mean, the presumed timeline is it's got to be soon, because they're not even in session next year and they do biennial budgets, right? So the presumed timeline is if this legislature and this governor are going to act, it'll be days, weeks, or months, but even months might, you know, it'll be probably more like days or weeks. But that's a big if right now, because as Jerry said, there's a lot of parties that have to agree to something that, and they're pretty far apart.
Great, thank you, Jerry and Nick. Any other comments or questions for Jerry for the Executive Director's report?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm just curious, and in, I believe it's a new business, there was the approval for the new actuarial tables for pension benefit presentation by CABNA. You know, maybe I'll just meet at the Jerry offline to maybe give me a better understanding how this impacts various groups.
Well, Molly, that's actually going to be the next item. Matt held off on that because of waiting for all the trustees to, you know.
Okay. I thought I completely missed something there. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Nope. Yeah. We're going to finish up item eight, and then we'll just definitely obviously jump back to the new business. But like Jerry said, I wanted to wait for Nick for us to have a full board.
Oh, thank you.
So moving on to item eight, informational, got items A through H. Any comments or questions on those? If not, we can place them on file.
Well, we have a legal, we have a an opinion from the city attorney's office regarding the outcome of the litigation. Patrick, did you want to mention anything about this? It was issued yesterday to the trustees. It went out yesterday.
Yes, thank you, Jerry. Everyone should have received a memo and a copy of the Wisconsin Supreme Court opinion summarizing the history and results of the litigation, which were unfortunately not what we were hoping for. I'll just give very brief comments. There will be more amplifying information within the memo, but I'm also obviously available right now to answer any questions any trustee has, or to have a more robust conversation offline if you'd like. Just to give the Cliff Notes version, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reversed the favorable Court of Appeals opinion in relation to the 5.8% pension offset payment, and ordered that that payment be included in disability benefits, duty disability retirement benefits moving forward. The basis of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's opinion was actually unique to the prior courts. It took a sort of third route that none of the other courts had focused on, and ruled that the textual structure of the agreement, specifically the salary grids, were determinative of the outcome of the case. And again, just the Cliff Notes version, because the salary grids contained within the collective bargaining agreement included the 5.8% increase at issue, the court ruled that that amount must serve as the current annual salary for purposes of calculating duty disability retirement. The court also rejected the argument that the Court of Appeals had previously accepted, that additional language within the contract effectively precluded its inclusion from duty disability, the so-called conditional language contained within Article 10 that specified that the 5.8% increase was contingent upon a member making a corresponding 7% member contribution. Two notes that I'd like to touch on basically in regards to implications, and that the first is the opinion is, I think, thankfully fairly limited The court did not really address some of the broader contractual rights arguments that were raised by the plaintiffs, which I think would have been a more damaging opinion, and instead limited its decision to specifically interpreting the unique language of the collective bargaining agreement. So from that perspective, the court's opinion is relatively limited in terms of legal significance and will likely not reach or have significant implications beyond the outcome of this case. The second is that the primary implication of the court's decision is financial. There is a breakdown of the retroactive payments that are necessary as a result of the opinion, essentially including the 5.8% salary increase in duty disability retirement benefits for both MPA and Local 215 members from the time they came due under the contract. And then, of course, the ERS must also begin including the 5.8% increase moving forward. There is a pre- and post-judgment interest that is applied to the Local 215 amounts by operation of statute. And there is a corresponding implication for conversion and GPS benefits, because those benefits are calculated not in precisely the same way, but in a fairly similar way to duty disability retirement. So for affected members, their conversion benefits when they reach retirement age, as well as their GPS payments, will also be subject to the increase. The final thing we noted in the memorandum is that the MPSO, after the Court of Appeals opinion, filed a motion for fees, claiming fees under what's called the Common Fund Doctrine. We have not received a decision on that motion, despite approximately a year passing since it was filed. We're confident that that motion will be denied, because the Common Fund Doctrine does not shift attorney's fees to the losing party, but instead spreads the fees amongst the prevailing party. So the odds that a court is going to shift fees to the defendants in this case based on the Common Fund Doctrine would be a drastic extension of that legal doctrine as we know it. So we're confident that there won't be an additional cost flowing from that motion. But that's the summary of the memorandum. As I said, there's more amplifying information within the document itself, but I would be happy to answer anyone's questions right now or to have a longer conversation offline if you'd like.
Thank you, Patrick. Any comments or questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Klusman has a question.
Yes, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, only one thing, Patrick, on that last point on the fees. I get in your report here on page 5 where the fund is now liable for the back payments that hadn't been made that come to about $3.6 million because the fund is responsible to pay for benefits, you know, based on what the Chapter 36 requires. But who pays the legal fees? The fund or the city? Because the fund didn't do this, and pretty much from what you summarized here, this was all city action on contract bargaining, and you said something in here about might give some guidance to future wording that should be used. So who pays those legal fees and that back interest?
So to be clear, there is no award of attorney's fees at this point, and we do not expect there to be one. So that won't be, or at least at this moment, is not an issue. If that changes, certainly I will bring it to the board's attention, but we are not anticipating an award of fees at this point in time.
You can stop there then. I thought that you, when you mentioned that common fund doctrine, that was some other spin on fund, on fees, because, you know, it does lay people think that whoever wins a case gets their fees paid, but I just thought that somebody was trying something different, and if there may not be fees at all, then it's the point's moot, so just forget it then.
Sure. And just to clarify, that it's actually the opposite. The state of Wisconsin ascribes to the American rule on attorney's fees, where each party bears their own costs unless there's a statute or some other common law doctrine that applies, which isn't the case here.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Any other comments or questions for Patrick? All right, not hearing any, we'll throw item B through H on file. And moving back to item 5, letter A, the approval of new actuary tables for pension benefits. Presentation by Kavanaugh McDonald. I believe we have Larry Langer with us. I'm going to frame this a bit differently, though. I'm going to ask Patrick McLean first to talk regarding the last paragraph in the memo. I think it's better that we have our, to frame our discussion potentially what Patrick thinks regarding, though we have not explored any potential legal issues with respect to adopting separate factors for different groups. So I thought, Patrick, if you want to address this first, and then we can have Larry go.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had an opportunity to look at this issue superficially. I should note that I, as an assistant city attorney, am not authorized to issue formal legal opinions. So if there is a desire to get a formal determination one way or another, that would have to come in the form of a city attorney opinion. But just I can say that looking at Chapter 36, the charter ordinance essentially grants the board the authority and discretion to adopt these tables. That authority and discretion is guided by the requirement that the board's decisions must comport with actuarial standards of practice. So as long as the options presented each comport with the actuarial standards of practice, the election of one set of tables over another would appear to be an act of discretion or policy for the board. And I have not seen or been presented with any legal issue or argument that I would see as somehow hampering the board's ability to make a policy decision on this issue, given its grant of authority under Chapter 36. So the long and short of that is, as long as the actuary can certify that the options would each meet with actuarial standards of practice, this issue appears to be a policy consideration and not a legal requirement one way or another for the board.
Thank you, Patrick. Any comments or questions for Patrick? All right, not hearing any. Mr. Langer, are you on the line?
Yep, I'm online. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry Langer from Kavanaugh McDonald Consulting, and you all have in front of you our letter concerning factors. I'm going to go through this, obviously, questions as we go along. Just to give a spoiler alert, you know, we have two options presented here, and they're both options that comply with actual standards of practice. So I appreciate Patrick McLean's intro to this. As we go through this, we'll go through the letter, and then there is staff was gracious enough to work with us to put together an example. Sometimes folks like seeing live numbers as they were, or live examples. And so the optional forms of payment is something that the history has been to update those after new assumptions are adopted. And we had a few different assumption changes that occurred with respect to this last go around. First is the list of new mortality rates that were adopted. And the second was the current factors are not based upon a 7.5% return. And so it's time to update them for the 7.5% return. So these optional forms of payments, I think you all understand how they sort of work. You know, when you have a, the benefit being paid is the maximum benefit that's payable for life. If you want other forms of payment, we make use of some concept called actuarial equivalence. What actuarial equivalence means is that an actuary puts a value on the maximum or lifetime benefit, and then a value on the optional forms of payment, you know, joint survivor payment. We put a value, and the value of those two pensions are different. And so to make them the same, which is the concept of actuarial equivalence, we provide these factors that are applied to the maximum benefit so that the system on average works out that they're not paying more or less as a result of the optional forms of payment. So in the past, there has been a single table of factors for all groups. And that process, or that you know, the single table is still a reasonable thing to do. There are several systems that make use of that type of policy, for lack of a better word. But there are some variations between the member groups that, you know, you could consider having a few different factors. There's different COLA amounts, and we do factor in COLAs. They do have an impact on the value of, that we place on benefits, but there are multiple cost of living schedules during retirement. For the first time this go around, there's different mortality rates for police and fire versus general employees. And then, you know, there is a difference in the male to female ratio for active police and fire, and it's different from active general members. All right. Now, whenever I see male and female in these optional forms of payments, when you look at these tables, they're not based upon the gender of the member, the participant, or the beneficiary. We cannot do that. We cannot charge a different rate for males versus females. That's a court case decided back in the 80s, whose name escapes me, and it's not a Milwaukee court case. It's a national court case, which says, hey, we can't charge, you know, for similarly situated members, we can't charge more or less for males versus females. And, you know, we obviously are going to continue keeping it the same. So the only factors that currently go into this is the age of the member and the age of the beneficiary. So if you'd go down just a little bit, starting with while, Perry, that'd be great. And thank you for driving. Up just a little bit, a little higher. Yeah, the while, Pete. And this is, you know, we could continue doing this in the single table way. I think both of these options are reasonable. But as we are going through this, and this is the first time CAVMAC has gone through these factors, we took a look at a few different tables, as it were. And so our calculations are based upon the provisions down at the beginning of page 2, down below. So the COLA schedules for general employees, there's a tier one members that receive no COLA. They receive a 2% COLA or no COLA, but 1.5% after a second, third, and fourth year, and 2% thereafter. Item two, the tier two received 2% COLA after the fifth year of retirement if they're receiving service retirement, and tier two members receive no COLA if they're receiving other than service retirement. It's different than police and fire. It's a COLA beginning of the first year of retirement equal to annual increase in CPIU capped at 3%. And for that purpose of that, we've made use of an assumption of 2.5 throughout that. In the past, we've just used one COLA schedule across all of these. And now, you know, you could potentially change it to be specific to the COLA. The second piece, now we have two mortality tables hanging out there, and you'll recognize these, the base mortality tables. You know, there's the general, for general employees, it's a general mortality table that we made use of with these adjustments to it. You'll note that, you know, the members we, you know, for the members, we make use of it's sort of a blend of male and female tables. Same thing with the beneficiaries. It's based on our analysis and digging through the data. Police and fire, we make use of the public safety mortality tables. And again, the blend of those. The male to female ratio, you can see down below item three. Again, we blend these, so it's sort of a non-gender type of mortality table. And you can see that for police and fire, for general members, it's sort of balanced 55-45. For police and fire, it's male to female. You can see it's 85% male, 15% female. And the beneficiaries, we got to send a new letter. It's not 15% male and 85% male. It's 15% of beneficiaries are male and 85% are female. That's what we baked into the factors. And we blended all the first three items into a 50-50 blend of the general factors and the police and fire factors. Now, for purposes of looking at this, we focus, you know, we have some illustrative items in the attachments to this letter. And it's important to note that you're looking at different age groups. For police and fire, we have to set factors for the ages when they generally retire from 48 to 58 is what we showed. I think we show factors from like age 20 up to age like 80 for all these groups, but we focused on the factors for the periods of time when they tend to retire. So what's the overall deal? If we go to multiple tables, you know, it's based upon the assumptions, well, the average impact for police and fire at these key ages is a small decrease. And I don't mean to say small, because any decrease or increase has some magnitude, but a decrease of about 0.2% to benefit on average, ranging from like 0.2% increase to 1% decrease. And for general, your one member is the average impact would be an increase of the benefit of about 0.9%, again, with some sort of range depending upon when the people actually retire. In tier two, it's an increase of about 1.6%. So there is a little bit of variation between these if you decide to go the different routes or different tables for these groups. I think the next page is sort of the segue to I think we can go on to the example, Terry. Any questions so far? Some of this might become clear when we go into the this example here, which again, we appreciate staff working this up with us. So I have an illustrative person here, and we have a in the green, we have a general member, and the blue, we have fire and police. And we have a typical final average salary and service years to get a benefit amount. That's all nice. I think the focus where we want to be looking at is down below where the survivorship factor, the factor we apply to the benefit for 100% membership, that's where we want to focus our attention here. So I'll look at general first. And for general, tier one, the current table would suggest a factor of 0.8603 be applied to the $2,000 per month benefit, arriving at a final monthly amount under that optional, the 100% joint survivor benefit of 1720.60. I think everyone sees that number. If we continue the current practice of using the same factors for all members, we end up with a reduction to 0.8448%, and resulting in a reduction to $1,689.60, or a reduction from the current monthly of about $31. If we go to separate tables, there's still a little bit of reduction for this particular scenario of about $4. Now when we go through this, I'm gonna focus on the general just for another second. difference between the 0.86 and the 8.8448, that is predominantly, you know, we don't have the changes in the underlying COLA that we make use of. The predominant reason for the change is a reduction in the interest rate from 0.8, you know, from the 8% that is in the current factors to the 7.5% in the proposed. The differences between the mortality tables, you know, general versus fire police, there's a little bit of difference. Most of it comes from the difference in the applying different, explicitly putting in the different COLA provisions. Going on to fire and police, we have a similar schedule here. You can see that the current table, and this is important because we're using age 53 for the participant and age 49 for the beneficiary for fire and police, which is very different from general, where we're using 63 and 59. Again, trying to grab tables for a period that they're likely to retire at. And you can see under the current table, the factor is 0.9080 for fire and police compared to 0.8603. Here's the deal. If we have a fire police member that was age 63 and 59, we'd be using the current table. It's the same current factor, 0.8603, right? It's just that we grabbed different age combination for the member and the participant. If we continue with the combined table, the reduction 0.9080 down to 0.8919, it's still a reduction in benefit. Again, that's predominantly due to the reduction in the interest rate, since we're using the same COLA conventions here. If we separate out the table, because the COLAs for the police and fire are a bit more generous, it results in a larger reduction. I can go into like a 2 or 3 minute talk on why that is, if folks would like. You know, what causes these factors to be different. And I think I've talked myself into doing that, but I'll take a breath and see if there's any questions at the moment.
Hey, Larry, it's Ed Bell. Yeah, that'd be great if you could just flush that out. Thank
sure.
you. But take a breath. Take a breath.
No, appreciate that. So, you know, when I try and picture these in my head, and my head might work a bit differently than other folks' heads because it's filled with just numbers and stuff. But when you think about this type of this type of adjustment we need to make, I sort of think of it as taking out sort of a policy, as it were, to cover your spouse. All right? Now, if I'm age 63 compared to age 53, it's more likely that this benefit is going to be triggered for the spouse, right? If I'm older, there's a better likelihood that, you know, as a participant, I'll be dying sooner, and this benefit will be triggered for my spouse. And that's why you see a little bit bigger reduction, you know, going from the 0.9080 down to the 0.8603, all right? Now, the difference in the, when we get into the separate tables, the reason that the general change is actually a slight increase is because we're reflecting their specific COLA provisions, which aren't quite as generous as police and fire. And those COLAs make a difference for the survivor. Right, sometime out in the future, if the benefit is triggered to cover the survivor, that benefit would be bigger if the COLAs result in a larger benefit. Hopefully that makes a bit of sense to folks. It makes sense as an actuary. But that's the summary of a nice example of the difference in factors between general and fire and police. We'll certainly continue to make use of the combined table. I'm sure there's a lot of actuarial issues to think about when you consider going from a combined table to separate tables for the different membership groups that go beyond the actuarial. Both of these, again, they're I think of them as sort of expanding or refining, as it were. And refining doesn't always necessarily mean an improvement. It's just more refined. We're getting a little bit more granular when we get into separating the tables. In terms of a recommendation, I'm ambivalent. I mean, these are both reasonable methods to go about as we're digging through this and putting it together. We just thought it was reasonable to present to the staff and then to the board and discuss it. That's it for my prepared comments. I'm, again, as always, delighted to take any questions you may have.
Larry, this is Jerry. I just want to make sure I heard you say something correctly. I think you might have misspoke a little bit. You said that there might be some actuarial issues beyond. You meant administrative issues, right?
I meant administrative. I mean, actuarially, we can create the tables. I think of administratively, more tables, or with more tables, you need to make sure you're pulling up the right table. And now we've split it into multiple tables as opposed to one, and it just adds to more administrative complexity. From an actuarial basis, both of these result in similar costs across the retirement system. It's just where do you assign the costs across each of the groups? Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah, and for the information for the trustees, in terms of administrative burden of having two tables instead of just one table, we would have to do some reprogramming of our merit system. Merits will actually, tell the counselors and the accounting and finance people which table to use. I mean, that's why we have an automated record-keeping system. But we'll have to reprogram it, and that will take some time, because we have to test things after we program them to make sure we get them right. And I'm told by our IT group that they think they can do it in a month, but I think that we should be conservative in our estimate and assume maybe it might take more than a month, maybe 2 months. But all this is to say that if the board adopts two tables today, it might push back the time a little bit for actual implementation until we can get the system programmed. Push it back by a couple of months, perhaps. Pardon me.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks, Jerry. Any comments or questions from board members?
Mr. Klusman, I got a question.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Larry, if I'm understanding you right, that these different tables are a new advent that they've just come out, where they're separate for police, fire, and general?
The tables we made use of underlying this, they came about in 2018 or 19. This is the first time that they've been implemented for the fund. These pub 210 tables.
Okay.
Public sector tables. I think the median, the snapshot date of the experience centered around 2010.
And then just to understand them, what are, like, how do they assign that? Are they combined fire and police, or is someone else combining them? Are there separate tables for fire and separate for police, or is it all one table? And are these Midwest or national? What pool do they draw on to decide for the further data? And then how does that play into the survivorship aspect, if you could explain? Because I'm a little lost, because to me the survivorship is, like you said, an insurance policy for the spouse, So isn't that more based on the lifespan of the survivor, or is it impacted also by the retiree? And then is it, like a lot of police fire have, you know, like we all have, I know people that were general city employees and police employees, vice versa in their careers. They did one before the other and the other before the one. What do we classify them as for these tables? Is it at the time of retirement or the type of pension they're drawing?
Sure, sure. So the tables, and if you could go back to page 2 just so folks can, of the letter, to take a look at it. So let me start on the mortality tables just in general, and the purpose of them. These 4 decades, the tables used in the public sector were based upon corporate plan tables. And as such, as a practicing actuary, if you had a large, if you had a different group, you were left with trying to adjust the table to reflect that group. With the advent of these tables, and I'll give a little bit of the process that they went about. These tables, there are the Pub 210 tables. There are 94 of them that were created and issued back in 2018 or 2019. And the tables get into they examined a lot of different splits when they went into this tables. They looked at geography. They looked at the type of employment of the member. They looked at the pay levels of the members as well. And they worked through a lot of different machinations. At one point in the mid-2015s, I was thinking that there would be a Midwest table, right? A Southeast table. And where they ended up going, they shifted gears and said, well, you know, even within the Midwest, you can have variations, say, you know, Minnesota folks versus Indiana folks. In the Southeast, you know, if you look at Mississippi and Florida, it's markedly different. And so they went the route of looking at, they found that a better differentiator was looking at the income of folks. Folks with typically higher incomes had better mortality. And then also, you know, sometimes when we look at these tables and we examined it, you know, we will look at a few different tables to see which one fits better, as it were. So you can see, like, for a healthy annuitant or general here, you know, when it says below median, you know, we made use of the below median mortality, meaning they live a little bit shorter. For police and fire, I mean, the thing I find a bit interesting with this, the police and fire, you look at the beneficiaries, they actually had, they're able to dice up the data and look at that contingent survivor under item 2B II, and that is based upon the contingents of, you know, police and fire. But it is police and fire, it's combined to public safety. When they didn't see a reason to split that. And maybe if we had a large system with a lot of data, maybe there'd be some, you know, compelled to maybe make some modest adjustments between police and fire, but here we didn't see it. The tables here that we're basing on, the broad tables are based upon the what was adopted for the in the experience study. The blending that we make use here, which we has done in the past, you know, is based upon looking at, you know, digging into the data and seeing what the proportions of folks who take the amounts. I know there was one more question you had in there, Tom. Give me a second. It was, so things like, you know, have someone that starts a general and moves on to police and fire. You know, I think you base it upon what they retire under.
Okay.
So, you know, and so you might step back and say, well, you know, well, that might be a different mortality. You know, we're looking at mortality across a group. So you'll notice some of the things that we don't have in here. You know, when we set these rates, we don't, you know, no one does like a medical check of the person. So we don't have, right. I don't mean to go, right? You can probably fill in the blank of that. You know, we don't charge, you know, Larry more than, I don't participate in the fund, but we don't charge Larry more than Tom because, you know, Larry can't stop eating hamburgers, right? And Tom looks like he jogs. You know, so we don't get into that minutia. We're looking across the whole.
Okay, yeah, so those people are more, you know, smaller data. The larger pool kind of floods that out. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Does it also, talking about, since you said COLA is one of the main driving factors of this costing of the liability you actually do equalize it for that actuarially equivalent benefit, that some people take survivorship not for their spouse, and the spouse is the only one eligible for the COLA. So would this scenario, if we approved it, affect those people negatively because we're factoring a COLA cost, which is a big piece of it, into this formula, and that some folks elect a survivor that is not going to get that COLA? Because you know, the only people that get our COLA, or the only survivors that get our COLA, are spouse. If I take my brother or something, or I even divorce my spouse in retirement, the spouse does not get the COLA. Are we baking that into the detriment of some?
Yeah, I mean, if you get a bit more granular and you know, if we expand these tables to reflect, you know, survivors that don't get COLAs versus getting COLAs, and you get into that level, we get a, the factors are different. You know, someone who, a survivor that's not eligible for the COLA pieces of it, that the reduction would not quite be as much as for others. And in looking at this, most of the difference, I don't think the difference between mortality, yes, there's some difference, but it's more the difference in the different COLA provisions that causes it. I know this is like a snapshot of a few different things we looked at, but we'd have to have tables, you know, again, more tables.
Yeah, and I guess that's my point, is that I'm not, you know, this is new. I just heard about this within the last 7 days when we got picked up the packet. But the thing that gets me, that, you know, that gets me, but it piques my interest, is that, you know, I'm about equity. I like the fact that, you know, you shouldn't charge one for the other, like how we pool health insurance, where that data bodes the opposite direction of what you're looking at doing here. But that be as it may, if COLA is the driving factor and we want to get particular from our combined pool right now, we really shouldn't stop at just two. We should do it right and factor for a table for COLA or not, because it is a large input item. And then also, when we're doing the generals, wouldn't it be appropriate, the tier one and tier two members you see in 1A, I, and II, those are significantly different benefit levels. So why are those being combined to the windfall of the one with the richer benefit and the detriment of the tier two employee with the lesser benefit? So if we're going to do this, I think we need to consider it right, because I it just appears to me from the surface right now, and I'm, you know, open to hear from you on that, that this is like a, not even a halfway, it's like a fourth 25% correction. And if we're going to do it, and I don't think there's a problem with what Jerry said, if you're going to reprogram the system, Jerry will tell you, and I've heard from him many times about merits and how many different permutations and things that it calculates for so many different classes. So really, we're not constricted, we're not restricted from doing it right. So please tell me what I'm missing here, because I see this as like a step, a 10-foot step to a 100-step solution.
Sure. So if I said two, I misspoke in the letter, and I didn't get into the letter, but in the letter we have Appendix A and B and C and D, and there's probably more. I mean, it's just illustrative for a few different of those, of the different factors that you would have. You know, page, and I'm sorry, Tara, I'm looking at my own thing. Yeah, you can see here, Appendix A, Appendix B for General Tier 1, and again, there's more than just these four. We just wanted to give you a taste, and we'd make it as granular as the different bullet provisions, if that's a direction the board would want to take.
No, thanks for giving us just, you know, like, we don't watch so much paper. So, okay, then you already are on to that, at Tier 1 and Tier 2 would be different. Our example graph, the colorful one at the end, is just, you know, one data point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. No, I appreciate the question, though, because every once in a while I'll do one of the Simpsons type of things. But
well, I have the luxury of not having all those numbers rolling around in my head like you do.
Yeah. It's a blessing. Trust me on that.
All right. And then my last question, and I'll leave you alone, is why now? What, this seems to me to be a policy decision, and we're just coming off of the experience study, and some of us have a headache, and we have a big investment committee meeting that we just cautioned everybody about next week, how important it is, and now this seems to be like a policy, a large policy decision that we just heard about. I mean, at least, and maybe I wasn't paying attention, but I usually try to pay attention, and I didn't see this coming, and it just seems like it. Why are we doing this now? Is there some reason?
Sure. So I think what we said is next step is the factors. And as we're looking at this internally, you know, our just like everyone else's profession, you know, everyone, you know, their jobs or how we go about what we do changes over the course of time. And as we're exploring this, we decided it would be good to let the board know that there are a couple of ways of going about this. I think, but I know history lessons sometimes are, you know, who cares, but not who cares, but history. Back in the beginning of my career, these factors were some funds I worked with. You know, if you wanted to cover your spouse, we hit your benefit with 85%. That was it.
Oh.
No. Yeah, I mean, it, and so we're blessed and cursed with more data, more computing power, and things of that nature. And when we explore this, there are certainly, we work with funds that have just what you're doing now and continue to make use of that, you know, policy, one table for all, right? And, you know, there are funds that, you know, they'll have different, even within the same fund, they will have different factors for different participants to reflect the mortality, COLA provisions, things of that nature. But, you know, and when we talk about COLAs even, I mean, sometimes the factors way back 20, 30 years ago wouldn't even take in consideration the COLA thing. You know, so it's just, again, continuation. We thought it'd be worthwhile to bring this to the board to discuss, and because it's a policy issue.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't mean it. Yep, I didn't mean it as a criticism, because I I've been yelled at before for bringing things up, and then people say, why are you bringing it up now? Well, you got to bring it up sometime. Would you have yelled at me last month when I brought it up, or next month when I brought it up? So yeah, that's a good explanation. Yeah, I was just wondering right now if there's something I missed. Good. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Tom. Mr. Chair. Thank you, Larry. Yes, is that Molly?
This is Mr. Leitcha.
Hi.
I actually was going to ask that same question, Tom, of why now? So thanks for asking it. Is this something that a lot of other pension plans have been doing, Larry? Do you know?
You know, in terms of, you know, the best I can say is I know it's out there. I know there's no survey work on this. Most plans, I will say, and that's probably just how big the plans are, or, you know, they just do it for their own reasoning. They'll stick with what we have here called, like, the combined or the continuation of the current policy. Moving on to the individual, we serve some plans that, you know, might be one retirement system. Mm-hmm. They might have, like, five different plans under it. You know, you have one system that covers what I call, think of as three distinctive employee types. If you had three separate plans, we might have three separate tables already. But here, you know, we have combined. I don't know if that went circular or not, but
no, And would you say then that the separate tables, or having the separate tables, is more accurate, for lack of a better term? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I always get tickled when folks talk about actual things inaccurate, but yes, I think this is the refinement where we're mm-hmm. we're drilling on and making it a little bit more specific.
Yeah.
To the provisions and the people being covered.
Okay. That's all I have for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Aisha. Any other comments or questions?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Conrad.
Yes, thank you. Larry, you know, when things are defined as best practices or become considered to be best practices, they generally get adopted. And my question is, has any organization with credibility made any statements or judgments about whether this would be considered a best practice? And I know this is a hard question to answer, because our fund is, as you say, it's really three separate plans, whereas, you know, if a fund were just a police fund, or a fire fund, fireman's fund, they would have a different answer, and perhaps a general employee fund would have a third answer. So, but my question is, though, would this be considered a best practice, or nothing's really been decided yet, or it's maybe not possible because it's hard to define a best practice for a fund that is composed as ours?
Yeah, you're right, that's a hard question, Rudy. In terms of best practice, I consider both of these to be, you know, prudent practices, and I don't know that, as an extra, I don't know that one is better than the other. I think it's a bit more precise, you know, going to these individual tables. But, you know, as I stated earlier, there are some things that we don't take in consideration to make these things even more precise. You know, we're still a handcuff, for instance, on making use of male costs versus female costs. So we have to blend there. And so I guess it's a function of, you know, what level is the board comfortable with how much blending we do. you know, here predominantly the I know mortality makes a little bit of a difference, but here we're blending the potential cost of the COLA for membership. Is that reasonable? Yeah, it is. So I don't think I'm used to best practices, and I have a list of different best practices when it comes to actuarial things, and a lot of them have to do with funding, and a lot of them have to do with setting assumptions for valuations and how we go about our GASB things. And the benefits administration, it's not quite as fleshed out, I think. I think another thing that, I will say this is a best practice, though, just to be clear. Updating the factor tables after each experience study, to me, is a good practice. And you would think that, well, every fund does this, don't they, Larry? No, they don't. I don't have a sense of it, and it's just anecdotal based upon what I've seen, but particularly with, and you think, well, maybe it's just smaller plans. Maybe it's just, some of those local plans Larry works on in Michigan, so he can go home and have a Coney Island hot dog. Some of those haven't updated their factors in 15 years, and they just choose not to. But there's also, I know at least one Citywide retirement system where they don't update it after every experience study. So I can step back and say, reviewing this every 5 years, to me, is the best practice, or with every experience study. But in terms of how granular make this, I think Trustee Klusman put it really nice. Who do you want? I think he called it an equity issue. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, Tom, but, if you're leaning more towards equity and trying to get granular and charging the members a more precise cost, as it were, then you go to this individual as opposed to continuing the past practice. But the past practice is fine. Did I answer, Rudy? Because sometimes I think I tap dance.
No, I think that was a good answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Rudy. Thank you, Larry. Any other comments or questions?
If nobody else does, Klusman has a roll-up.
Go ahead, Tom.
Larry, you were exactly right. So, you don't want to put words in my mouth. That was how I feel about the equity part. So I would suggest that since COLA is such a major input into this, that we ask Larry to give us what that looks like, if he can run that, but in the same time to run concurrent, ask for formal legal opinion. I know I respect Patrick's initial words on it, and probably it's going to come out that way, but you never know until you start opening the books and taking a look. So I would suggest before we make a decision on this, we look at the legal, because it is a policy decision, that would be prudent. I don't feel comfortable making a policy decision without a legal opinion, especially since this is the first time we've done this. We're not changing the policy. Kind of, to me, we're starting a whole new road. And then in the meantime, have Larry see if he can do that COLA, non-COLA, because otherwise there's a serious equity issue with non-COLA survivors, if that's the will of the rest of the board.
Thank you, Tom. I have a comment, but I'll open it up first to others. Not hearing any. My comment is also similar, Tom, on one point. I think Patrick, thanks for your weighing in on it first. There was a little caveat you put, though, that it might be looked into a little more deeper, and maybe a formal opinion might be better. That's what I would lean towards too, as well, in agreeance with Tom. That's all I have. Any other comments? Or is everyone okay with that thought?
Great, I guess.
Getting the opinion.
So am I. Great.
Thank you, Aicha. Thank you, Deborah.
Yeah, this is Molly. I completely agree. I full confession, this thing is really confusing for me. It's going over my head. And, you know, just seeing it within the last couple of days, I'm fully not grasping what we're asked to do. So I think it's a good idea just to ask some of more expertise than I have, I guess.
Yes, it's Rudy. I think we should get an opinion. There may be some niches out there we haven't thought of.
Great, thank you. I think that's everyone. Anything, Mr. Kovac?
No, it's been a good discussion. I've got nothing to add.
Great, thank you. So, Jerry and Larry, are we understanding what Mr. Kleesman was asking? And of course, Patrick, I think you have a good idea as well. Moving forward, is that... the understanding, how much time would you need, Larry, to address the COLA question?
I'll need to circle back. I mean, I'd like to say we'll be back in May. I'd also like to say but I'll get back. I mean, we'll shoot for May. You know, June, we're in the throes of the actual evaluation. And it sort of, it thumbs us up a little bit. So it may slip to June. We'll work on it. We'll work with staff to get some more information. All right, if that works, sure.
Great. Thank you, Larry and Patrick. What time frame do you think?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would give relatively the same response. The only reason I hesitate to say I won't have something for you next month is because of the release of the state legislation. I don't know how much of my time over the next month that's going to take up. So I'll certainly prioritize this and try and have something back to the board within the next 30 days, but I have to include that caveat that depending on what happens with the state legislation, that may not be possible.
Excellent. If you give it a shot, and we understand the your concerns, and just keep us updated. And then Jerry, can we throw that then on the agenda then for next month?
Absolutely, and I'll request an opinion formally as well on behalf of the board.
Excellent.
Yep.
Great. Well, I think that completes our discussion. Open it up one last time for any comments or questions before I entertain a motion to end the meeting.
Mr. Chair, real quick.
Yeah, is that Tim?
Yep.
Go ahead, Tim.
Just a comment for Patrick. I didn't get the memo. With the pension offset issue. I'm not sure if you have my email. I think I've gotten emails from you before, but I didn't get your memo.
I apologize. I will be sure to have it sent out to you today.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Patrick. And do I have a motion to conclude the meeting?
All right, moves to adjourn.
Thank you, Conrad. A second?
Helen, a second.
Thank you, Helen. And any objections regarding? Not hearing any objections. The motion is adjourned at 10:35 a.m. Everyone have a